Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ, 89.1 FM Descanso, recording in our studio in the East County Wellness Center in El Cajon. In top news today, we'll have the latest from the 52nd Congressional District race. You'll also hear about a doctor who has been arrested for sexually abusing his patients, and also on Crime Beat about the sentence handed down to a man convicted of raping women he met through a Christian online dating site. Hear about a fireworks show gone amiss during the Aztecs' homecoming game over the weekend, causing injuries in the crowd. Learn why health authorities are warning parents about dangers posed by laundry pods, which have poisoned thousands of children. And hear about a horse in rural East County that was attacked by a pack of dogs. On Tribal Beat, Leon Thompson continues his interview with Kumeyaay Elder Charlie Brown, this time talking about the history of tribal gaming and how that's impacted life both on Native American reservations and in the broader community here in East County. On Bookshelf, Raina Menashe speaks with La Mesa Police Captain Dan Willis about his new book, Bulletproof Spirit, written to help police officers overcome traumatic experiences on the job. From Public News Service, hear why the FDA is being sued over a cocktail of drugs given to farm animals. And on Green Scene, find out why a judge has tossed out San Diego County's climate change plan as inadequate. We will also tell you about a benefit event coming up to help Descanso's famous saddle maker, Gary McClintock, who was injured in a motor vehicle accident, and we'll replay Helen Oldfield's Sounds of History interview with Gary McClintock that previously aired on our show. So stay tuned for today's edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show.
Republican Carl DeMaio conceded defeat Sunday to Democrat Scott Peters in the hotly contested 52nd Congressional District race. On election night, DeMaio was on top by a slim margin, but as provisional and absentee ballots delivered to polling places came in, Peters took the lead by over 4,700 votes. Associated Press called the race in favor of Peters this weekend with less than 10,000 ballots left to be counted. DeMaio told a UT San Diego reporter, "Because I care about San Diego, I wish Mr. Peters the best and hope he will endeavor to represent the district well." The loss is the second in a row for DeMaio, who previously lost his bid on the mayoral primary race. His campaign was plagued by allegations of sexual harassment from two male aides, one publicized just 2 days before the election. DeMaio, an openly gay candidate, has denied the allegations. The first accuser had in turn been accused by the DeMaio campaign of a break-in at campaign headquarters. District Attorney Bonnie DeManus declined to press charges against either DeMaio or his accuser, finding insufficient evidence. Peters attracted support not only from a core Democratic base, but also from the San Diego Regional Chamber of Commerce for his pro-economic growth voting record during the freshman term in Congress. His victory is a bright spot for the Democrats in an otherwise challenging election season that resulted in Republicans regaining control of the Senate and widening the margin of control in the House of Representatives. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Leon Thompson.
A doctor who volunteered at Volunteers in Medicine in El Cajon and other facilities has been arrested and charged with 24 felony counts related to sexually abusing his patients, 10 News reports. The charges include 15 felony counts of sexually penetrating an unconscious victim, 8 counts of sexual battery, and 1 count of child pornography. Authorities found that he had taken over 1,300 photos of his patients, nude or semi-nude. 4 women claimed that Dr. Abrams acted inappropriately. A nurse has confirmed at least one instance in which he touched a patient inappropriately. Dr. Abrams is 67 years old and has practiced medicine for over 40 years. In addition to the El Cajon Clinic, he's also volunteered at UC San Diego's School of Medicine and at a clinic in Vista. The state medical board has suspended his license, finding that his actions were extreme departures from the standard of care for patients. Dr. Abrams was removed from an incoming flight at Lindbergh Field and taken into custody on Friday. We have another Crime Beat report today. A man convicted of raping two women he met on ChristianMingle.com, a dating site for Christians, has been sentenced to 37 years to life in prison by Superior Court Judge Daniel Goldstein in El Cajon. The judge said Banks' hatred for women is appalling based on statements Banks made to investigators. The prosecutor called Banks a sexual predator who has shown no remorse for the violent assaults on two women, including one from La Mesa. Gloria Allred, a prominent women's rights attorney, was also in court with one of the victims, UT San Diego reports. She urged women to be aware of the risk of online dating and urged that other victims of predators met through such services report the attacks promptly to authorities. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
The annual KGB Skies Show provided a dazzling fireworks display to cap off San Diego State Aztec's defeat of the Idaho State Vandals Saturday night at SDSU's homecoming game in Qualcomm Stadium, but a mishap sent fireworks into the crowd after a fireworks launcher reportedly tipped over. A CBS News report indicated up to five people may have been hit, including an 11-year-old who suffered burns to his chest and legs. 10 News reports that Pyro Spectaculars by Sousa, the company that put on the fireworks display, has been involved in several other fireworks mishaps. In 2010, a fireworks rocket misfired into a crowd in San Marcos on the 4th of July, injuring four people. In 1996, an employee was killed when the company's manufacturing plant exploded. In three other cases, Pyro Spectaculars employees reportedly suffered injuries. Pyro Spectaculars has been in business for over 90 years and has organized major fireworks displays globally, including the 2004 Summer Olympics in Greece, the 125th anniversary of the Statue of Liberty in New York, and several Super Bowls. The company has not responded to media requests for comment, though its website states that the company takes seriously safety concerns, working closely with the safety professionals to assure that the highest safety standards are utilized. It remains unclear what caused Saturday's accidents or what steps will be taken to protect audiences at Pyro Spectacular's fireworks shows in the future. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Leon Thompson.
A pack of six dogs attacked a horse in Deerhorn Valley on Saturday. Karen Sample heard her horse Sergio panicking and came out to find the horse kicking to defend itself against six dogs circling the frightened animal, lunging and biting. She fired a shotgun in the air to scare off the pack of dogs, the Deerhorn Valley Antler reports. In an alert sent to residents, the Antler's editor Kim Hamilton warns six unrestrained dogs roaming as a pack and harassing or attacking fenced livestock is a very serious safety issue for our Deerhorn Valley animals and humans alike. The attack occurred at Spice Way near Deerhorn Valley Road, where the horse was in a corral. Hamilton said she called animal control to summon help, but the dispatcher refused to send help because the call came from a third party, even after Hamilton explained that there was no cell phone service where the attack occurred. She then called 911, and that operator dispatched a sheriff's deputy. Five of the dogs, four black, one tan, have been located and reportedly are now secured. The fifth dog, a pit bull mix, remains missing. The Antler reports that the dog owner's landlord was horrified at the news and believed the new tenants only had two dogs and would fence the property before they moved in. Unlike coyotes or mountain lions that kill only when they're hungry, packs of dogs may actually kill for sport, leaving the carcasses untouched. It's a likely sign that it was dogs and not wildlife. Hamilton warns, working as a pack, they can easily take down a horse and inflict serious or fatal injuries before moving on. Now, according to an ASPCA document titled Predatory Behavior in Dogs, a single dog is unlikely to pose a threat to livestock or large wildlife, for that matter. But the ASPCA cautions, packs of dogs, however, have reportedly caught and killed deer, pronghorn antelope, and livestock, including cattle, sheep, and goats. Dogs don't hunt because they're hungry. A group of dogs can do serious damage to a herd of sheep or goats, killing large numbers of the animals. In Houston, a pack of dogs killed eight horses at a stable in January last year, Fox TV in Houston reported. And the same month, a sheriff's deputy in Florida shot and killed a pack of dogs that had attacked and seriously wounded two horses. In August 2014, ABC Channel 6 reports three miniature horses in Aiken County, South Carolina, were also killed by dogs, to cite just a few examples. owners who allow their dogs to run loose could face serious penalties. In most areas, it is legal for livestock owners to kill a dog if it harasses, injures, or kills livestock, although the livestock owner may be required to prove that the dogs actually posed a threat. Moreover, dog owners are financially responsible for any livestock harm caused by their dogs, and here in California, the owner of livestock injured or killed by a dog can sue the dog's owner for double the actual financial loss. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ in Descanso, the heart of East County, this is Miriam Raftery.
This is Leon Thompson with an important health warning for parents, grandparents, and caregivers of young children. Laundry pods are colorful packets of liquid detergent intended to offer convenient use in washing machines, but to kids, they look like candy or juice. Over 17,000 children have been poisoned or injured by laundry pods, an average of one child every hour. 30 of those children went into comas, a dozen suffered seizures, and one child died. Children who swallowed or inhaled the products also suffered vomiting, choking, coughing, drowsiness, and eye irritations. Half of the exposures were minor, but the rest, that's about 8,500, were serious poisoning cases, and 769 required hospitalization after the contents of laundry pods, or what they now call poison pods. Those are the findings of a study published in the Journal of Pediatrics conducted by the researchers at Nationwide Children's Hospital. The Centers for Disease Control has previously published a report warning medical professionals to be aware of the risk of laundry pod poisoning in young children. Dr. Gary Smith, author of the study, believes packaging is not adequately regulated, CBS News reports. Some manufacturers of laundry pods are taking steps to put warning on packaging and educate parents and others who care for small children. Parents are advised to keep laundry pods stored in locked cabinets up high out of children's reach if you use them at all. The contents are highly concentrated since just one small pod will wash an entire load of laundry or send a child to the emergency room.
You are listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM, Descanso.
This is East County Magazine's Tribal Beat, bringing you news for and about our region's Native American communities. This is Leon Thompson with East County Magazine, and I'm back with Kumeyaay Elder Charlie Brown. And Charlie, since the 70s, or even before that, there's been a change in the Indian nations partly because of gaming. What is the history in San Diego, briefly, of gaming?
Well, the history started probably late 60s, started out with bingo, and that started in Saquon. Anda Sandoval was the first person to start that idea. They started out in bingo, and bingo was very successful at the time because we could give money away more than any other bingo could give away because we were a sovereign nation. That caught on to the other tribes like Viejas and Verona. It took us a while to get those other two tribes started, and they started in bingo. And as it gradually grew bingo, we started into putting slot machines in. Of course, the state didn't like that, and the federal government didn't like that because we were doing gaming that they didn't feel we had the right to do. But of course, we were a sovereign nation, and a sovereign nation is like a government inside a government. We have a tribal chairman who's like our president, and we have certain officers run like officers that the president has. They fought us for several years. State was the hardest ones to convince, and states wanted their hands in everything. You know how the state is. Yes. Anytime somebody's successful in something, they want a piece of it.
In fact, Governor Schwarzenegger wanted a big piece.
Yeah, he's greedy, you know.
He wanted $1 billion from the Indians, and he got them.
So. Yeah, he's always that way, you know. I'll be back.
He came back and back and back.
Yeah,
he kept coming back.
Yeah, he had his hands out, you know. He couldn't get enough of us, but we continued to challenge the state. And the state said, you run in slot machines. And so we went to court, And we brought a lotto machine in and one of our slot machines in. And we opened them up and we put them on them. And we opened up their lotto machine and we told them, I says, look at them. There's nothing different than your lotto machine than our slot machine. All they do is they project something on a screen. There is no wheels that turn like a slot machine does. And everybody goes, you're right.
Well, one of the things I think people don't realize is that there's 64, how many tribes out there in California that are so remote that it isn't practical to have gaming. But yet, Barona, Viejas, Sequan, some of the ones that have the successful gaming, share.
Yeah, what we did before we got into a major compact with the state of California, this is when we first started opening. We started a revenue sharing here locally with the local tribes. And every month we would give a revenue sharing to the tribes that couldn't have gaming. One of the things that happened was very touching to us was a lady in Los Coyotes, and that's out near Warner Springs.
Very remote area.
Yeah. We actually gave them enough money to give them power to some of the houses. She was crying, and she said when she was a kid, her mother read to her by kerosene lamp. She was 86 years old at the time, and she had an ice box that she put ice in to keep her stuff cold. And she was reading to her grandkids by kerosene lamp. She was so grateful that she was offering what little she had to us. In our beliefs, we have to take what they offer. Because if we don't take, that's bad. So we take what she offered. Wasn't much, but we did take. So we did that with the revenue sharing that they got. And one of the wishes she said, before I die, she said, I hope I could get a flush toilet in my place. Because they didn't have flush toilets. They had outside toilets still.
And this is not... We're not talking about 50 years ago. We're talking about...
Yeah, we're not talking 50 ago. Goals. We're talking 10 years ago, yeah. Maybe 15 years ago, yeah. At which a lot of people take this all for granted. And some of these people live in poverty still. We're trying to help them. But like Leanne was talking about, now we give our money goes directly to the state of California. That was the biggest mistake I think we ever made. Because it built all this money up, and the state of California had a hard time deciding how to distribute it to the tribes that didn't have gaming. And it built up real big. So all these eyes in the state government was figuring out how they get a piece of this money. How could I get part of this money? How can I get my hands on this money? All the legislators, all these... Caltrans, all these other entities was trying to figure out how I can get part of this millions and millions of dollars that are building up every time.
And they were meant for the tribes to have, to educate their children and to have police and fire on their reservations.
Yes. And it was actually, some of it was to get back to some of the communities to have fire protection here in some of the communities in the state of California. And some of the money did come back to San Diego County to buy fire trucks and things for fire protections and police protection stuff here in San Diego County. They were awarded some of the money, but everybody was trying to get their hands on it, you know. And finally, after 5 years of the money building up, they finally decided how to do it. So now every year they distribute it once a year to the tribes. And it's usually in about February they receive the money. So all those tribes that don't have gaming, or if they have gaming, they can't have over 750 machines. They get a revenue sharing from all the gaming tribes that have a large gaming facility.
One thing I'm really proud of the tribes here locally, and my tribe back in Minnesota, was that they give back to the community. Once they've become successful, they've been able to share. And that's been a source of great pride to see the way the, in spite of all the history, yet they're the most generous people around.
Yeah, that's one of the things you can't realize, that We've been through a lot, and people ask me, how do you do it? And it says, you know, if we had to fight every battle, we'd still be fighting. We turn the other cheek, and we continue forward. One of the things we decided that when we came successful, that we would give back. Because when we were fighting for our lives, we didn't have a lot to eat. We were poor. People took us in and shook the dirt off us, gave us a chance. We've been around here for 12,000 years. People haven't believed that. We survived everything that we've been through. We're warriors. We decided we would give back. We have never asked for people to hand us anything. We've never reached out. We never stuck our hand out to nobody. We give. We never ask for anything back. And it feels good in our heart. Makes us feel good. Makes us feel good that we can go and do that. And it even makes us feel good that we can go out sometimes when we see somebody struggling. If everybody would look at what it is, there's a lot of people down and out there. And if everybody would look in their heart, deep in your heart,
being able to give something back is the biggest reward. Viejas, the Verona, Sequan, La Posta, all the little tribes here in San Diego County, they've done real well for themselves, and they're a lot to be proud of. The Sequan powwow was a wonderful powwow. A lot of camaraderie, a lot of closeness in the families. So much participation in the dancing and singing and drumming, too. It was a wonderful place to be. And I'm really privileged to have you here, Charlie, talk about some of these things. And we'll talk again. This has been Leon Thompson here on East County Magazine. And I want to thank Charlie. And we'll have you back again.
Yes, you will. And it's my pleasure again. And it's really humble to speak about our Kumeyaay Nation. And we're a proud people. We're not going anywhere. And we'll be here for the next 10,000 years.
That's right.
Thank you.
This is a public service announcement from the nonprofit East County Magazine regarding the Viejas Wildfire and Emergency Alert Service. During a wildfire, it's critical to receive timely news about evacuations, shelters, threatened communities, and other vital information. Viejas Wildfire and Emergency Alerts are available free to the public via email, or you can receive the alerts via Twitter on your mobile phone. You can get information on how to sign up for these free alerts at www.eastcountymagazine.org. The Viejas Wildfire and Emergency Alerts are produced by East County Magazine with support from the Viejas Band of the Kumeyaay Nation. The East County Magazine Show on KNSJ Radio is produced by the nonprofit Heartland Coalition. We're your community news. We reflect your interest, not special interest. You can get involved by volunteering, get trained to be a citizen journalist, and support East County Magazine at www.eastcountymagazine.org. And you can send your news tips and story ideas to editor@eastcountymagazine.org.
You're listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, networking for social justice.
Welcome to Bookshelf, bringing you stories of local literary luminaries and some great books to read. My name is Raina Menashe, and I'll be your host for this segment. Today I'm interviewing La Mesa Police Captain Dan Willis, author of Bulletproof Spirit, the first responder's essential resource for protecting and healing mind and heart. My guest, who is a homicide investigator and former SWAT commander, has developed a wellness program providing emotional survival to first responders. Much needed. Welcome, Captain Willis. It's a pleasure having you on Bookshelf.
Thank you very much. It's my pleasure to be here.
Let's start with your 25 years of service in East County. What have you experienced and witnessed about how emotional trauma affects first responders? And I know that includes police officers, firefighters, EMTs, emergency room personnel, and soldiers. What I'm asking is, what provoked you to write this book?
Well, over my 26 years, I've seen not only within myself, but in so many of my colleagues, how the adverse effects of the job, of being immersed in heartache all the time, seeing so much violence and death and suffering, how that really does take a tremendous emotional toll on those who serve. And often it's very toxic, and debilitating to their spirit. And it can lead to depression, to substance abuse, burnout and cynicism. Far more than half the people who start a first responder profession never finish to full retirement.
Really?
So there really is a disheartening status of how well our first responders are doing, because a lot of them are really suffering and need help.
Now, what's the symptom that you see the most often in your own staff?
There's several. For me personally, it was becoming what I call emotionally dead. Mm-hmm. I noticed after about 7 or 8 years on that I really didn't have any feelings anymore. I wasn't happy. I wasn't sad. I didn't feel connected to anybody or anything. I didn't feel engaged with my wife and stepkids. Just very numb inside. And looking back on it, that was a way to try to survive in the midst of heartache and dealing with people's tragedies. Unfortunately, that obviously plays havoc with your personal relationships.
Right.
And that was kind of a wake-up call of, this isn't normal, this isn't right, and I really need to look at myself, become more self-aware of how the job's adversely affecting me, and do something proactive about it.
Right. And is that also what you see in your staff, people working with you?
That's a very common one, is this emotional numbing. But another very significant symptom is sleep disorders. Most first responders get about 4 hours of sleep, maybe 5 on average, and people really need 8 or 9 to be able to function normally, to process stress and to feel and be well. And if you're getting 4 or 5 hours of sleep day in, day out, on top of dealing with the acute stress and the trauma of the job, I mean, that's going to have a significant impact on your quality of life and your overall wellness. Another sign that I see is anger, that people tend to get angry at the smallest of things, things that would never bother them before. And that's just a sign, another sign, that they're not processing stress in a positive, constructive manner.
So that really brings us to talking about the official diagnosis of PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder. And I know that the symptoms that you've named are connected to that. But what do you think that the public needs to know about PTSD?
The public, I think, really needs to understand that there's approximately 120,000 police officers in America who are going to work every single day with full symptoms of PTSD, and many of them not really realizing what they have. And the symptoms go far beyond what we were just talking about. That they are acute panic attacks, nightmares, reliving trauma that they've experienced over and over and over again. It becomes very, very debilitating. So PTSD is really a byproduct of all the negative things that we see when we don't train our first responders how to protect, heal, and nurture their spirit. And there are really some effective treatments for PTSD out there. And writing the book was just a way of trying to get, in part, that message out, that we really need to look for help and go ask for it. That PTSD is not a weakness. It's really not about what's wrong with you. It's all about what happened to you. And it really is an injury to your brain's ability to process a traumatic event. And there are therapies that will help your brain heal and put that event in its proper perspective so you can move on without the memories being crippling.
Well, it sounds like another main point is that the event doesn't have to have happened directly to you. You can experience vicarious trauma by witnessing it.
Oh, very much so. Not only just witnessing it from our brother, sister, officer, but often we suffer with our victims as well. I mean, if you spend 5, 7, 8 hours with a traumatized sexual assault victim who was brutally raped, how do you go home and be a happy, engaged father, mother, or spouse? I mean, you really can't. And the ways that we try to deal with it without any proper training is often substance abuse, isolating ourselves from our family so we can just kind of deal with it on our own. And these things are really self-destructive and aren't helpful at all.
Right. Okay, well, let's go to your book. What are some of the main lessons or strategies described in Bulletproof Spirit? Without giving a spoiler, can you explain to us what kinds of strategies you suggest and promote?
Well, the first and probably the most critical principle is to learn to become more self-aware. When I go around teaching emotional survival to first responder agencies, I always ask them, now raise your hand if the job has negatively affected you, affected your health and wellness, your view on people and life, and your quality of your life. And every single person always raises their hand immediately. So if the job is adversely affecting us very negatively, there's got to be something that we can do on the proactive side that will help counteract some of that. But if we're not aware, because a lot of these negative aspects are very slow, they're very insidious as far as how they affect us. I like to call it, it's like a cancer of the spirit. And before you know it, over time, you've become someone that your loved ones no longer recognize. And at that point, often it's too late. So I like to tell people to engage their loved ones, solicit feedback, ask them, how is the job changing me? How am I different? And if you see me not being myself, please come to me and ask me what's going on and give me that information so I can do something about it before it is too late.
And do you suggest any strategies for the doing something about it?
The book itself has over 40 wellness strategies and emotional survival methods. Basically, it's up to the individual officer to take information such as in Bulletproof Spirit and find what works for them. And I've done all 40 that I described in the book. Some are more effective than others. But the main thing is to find things that are going to be life-affirming for you throughout your career, because a career can be life-depleting. Right. So often first responders stop doing the things they loved before they became a cop.
Oh, that's a good example.
So you got to keep the friends that you had outside of the agency. Do those things that you loved. For me, it was being in nature, bike riding, hiking, going to national parks. I love swimming in the ocean. A lot of those things I kind of stopped doing when I first became a cop. And when you start doing those things again and be active and force yourself to be engaged in your personal life and with the people that are your lifeline of support, you can weather a lot of the storms of the spirit that you're going to face.
Well, that leads us to your training program, which is on emotional survival and wellness. And you've described strategies for getting there and for staying well mentally and physically, because I know the two are connected. Where has the gap been traditionally in these areas? What kind of training do you believe first responders usually receive, and where is it lacking?
Well, that's a great question, because traditionally, the only training first responders receive is for your mind and the body. You know, they teach you about the laws and how to handle certain instances and procedures, and they will tell you to be physically fit, but they have always neglected the most important part of us, which is our spirit. And our spirit, I like to define as everything that's not of our mind and our body. It's what helps us to process stress, to overcome trauma, and to want to serve with compassion. It's our resiliency to acute stress. It's our motivation and inspiration to want to devote ourselves to a life of public service. And our spirit is really the foundation of our mental health, our physical health, our emotional health. And if we neglect the spirit, then we're neglecting our overall health and well-being. So the emphasis of the book, which I hope will become more and more part of the curriculum in training first responders, is to teach them to nurture and to protect their spirit, because the spirit is really going to keep their mind and their body and their emotions well. So the emphasis is more on those things that are life-affirming, which breathes life into your spirit, which brings joy back into your life, which helps renew your mind, your emotions, and your inspiration and motivation to keep wanting to serve year in and year out.
I know that you are going to retire soon from being a La Mesa police captain. Are you planning to train first responders yourself as you move through your retirement?
Oh, definitely. In fact, for the past 10 years, I've been an instructor at the San Diego Police Academy, and with the publication of the book that just came out a few weeks ago, I've already been booked to teach in Kansas regarding emotional survival and the strategies that are in the book. So I hope as the word gets out, I'll be asked to travel around the country and present training seminars to help get the word out about the essential and critical need to offer that kind of training to protect and heal the spirit.
What feedback have you gotten from the people who have received your training?
Pretty much universally, I hear, I really wish I had this kind of information when I started my career. So, I mean, people really do know how negative and harmful the job can be, but we've never really had anything to help us through it.
Right.
So now, hopefully this is, that, and our first responders will find this very, very useful and meaningful to them.
Well, it sounds like you're doing a really much needed project.
Oh, thank you.
One last question. Is there another book in the wings, or are you going to focus on promoting what you've already written?
There's not really another book right now. I really want to devote myself, now that I'm at the end of my career, to helping to protect and help those who are going to be coming after me. I mean, we all depend on first responders for our life and well-being. And so often the general public just really doesn't understand how much they're suffering in their service. I mean, they're the only ones that protect and give life to people. And often it's their own life, their own emotional. Absolutely.
Right.
So I really want to continue my devotion to helping those I've served with and those following me, to teach them what I've learned through trial and error, mostly error, but what has really worked not only with me, but what I've seen with other first responders. So hopefully they'll make it to a full retirement, be prideful about the service they've been able to do throughout their adult life, and be happy that they were able to affect so many people for the good and in a positive way, and be happy and healthy themselves.
Would you like to finish with a word of hope for the first responders themselves, if they happen to be listening?
Well, the book offers a tremendous message of hope, a very positive message that you don't have to be victims of your career. I mean, so often it seems like first responders kind of hope for the best. They get involved in a fatal shooting, a critical incident happens, and the agency is kind of there for the first week or so, and then it's not talked about, and everyone just kind of quietly, gee, I hope that person gets over it. I hope they're okay. We can't just hope anymore. Suicide is the number one cause of death for police officers every single year in the United States. Nearly 200 kill themselves. And we can't just hope for the best and lose so many devoted heroes. It's a senseless shame, especially when there's information that can really help them.
Okay, so the information is out there. They just have to find it, and they can do that through your book.
Absolutely.
Okay, well, our time is up. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.
If you would like more information on Captain Dan Willis and Bulletproof Spirit, please visit firstresponderwellness.com. Again, this is Raina Menashe, and you have been listening to East County Magazine's Bookshelf, bringing you stories of local literary luminaries and some great books to read.
You are listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, broadcasting from the desert to the sea.
Pharmaceuticals, it's what's for dinner, and groups in the U.S. are suing the federal government over it. The Humane Society of the United States, the United Farm Workers of America, and the Animal Legal Defense Fund filed a lawsuit in San Francisco over a new cocktail of growth-enhancing drugs and antibiotics. Hannah Connor, an HSUS staff attorney, says it's fed to millions of pigs, turkeys, and cows. She says they filed the lawsuit over the FDA's failure to investigate the long-term effects of the drugs.
We think that they need to take a really hard look and make sure that when approving these varieties of drugs that have huge impacts, not only to the environment, but also to animals and to workers and to human health, that they really need to do a meaningful review.
At the center of the lawsuit is the drug ractopamine, as well as combinations of these drugs with other growth hormones and steroids, many of which have been banned in other countries, such as China and Russia, because of risk to human health. Connor says studies that have been conducted in the U.S. regarding the drugs are troubling.
What they actually showed was some real concern, especially when the drug is absorbed directly by a human.
She adds the overuse of these drugs can make humans resistant to antibiotics used in medicine to treat human illnesses. Other major concerns for the groups are what they say are well-documented adverse effects the drugs have on the animals, the exposure of the drugs the farm workers face, and the vast amount of animal waste from large-scale farms, which leaches into water and soil and can adversely affect wildlife. According to the Humane Society of the United States, the FDA has never prepared an environmental impact statement or an environmental assessment on the combined effects of the drugs. The lawsuit asked the court to set aside the FDA's approval of the drugs until the agency performs a review, which is required under federal law. For California News Service, I'm Monique Coppola.
If you bought a Fantasy V California Lottery ticket at the 7-Eleven store at 14110 Old Highway 80 in Flint Springs, just east of El Cajon, you could be instantly rich. A ticket worth nearly $408,000 matches this week's winning numbers of 3, 12, 14, 32, and 34. But the winner has not yet come forward to claim his or her prize. The lucky winner has up to 6 months to turn in the winning ticket and claim the money. This is Leon Thompson reporting for East County Magazine.
Now it's time for the Green Scene Report, highlighting energy, environmental, and sustainability issues in our community.
This is Miriam Raftery with a Green Scene Report. The county's climate action plan lacks teeth to assure that greenhouse gas emission goals will be met, California's 4th District Court of Appeals has ruled. The appellate court upheld a San Diego County judge's ruling in a lawsuit filed by the Sierra Club. Sierra Club argued that the county's reliance on voluntary measures and lack of clear deadlines were not enough to reduce greenhouse gas emissions by the targeted amounts by 2020. The court also noted that the county rejected mitigation proposed by the Sierra Club without valid reason. Charlene Ayers, a backcountry issue blogger with The Ranter's Roost, has asked the county if the decisions might mandate a redo of the general plan update, since the climate change plan was adopted as part of the 2011 general plan update, and that affects land use planning in the county's unincorporated areas. County land use environmental planner Eric Lardy responded that the county is currently reviewing the court decision and coming up with its next steps over the next few months. A prior court decision in a lawsuit filed by Cleveland National Forest against the San Diego Association of Governments, or SANDAG, over the county's regional transportation plan similarly found that it was not adequate to reduce greenhouse gas emissions that contribute to climate change. Duncan McFetridge, spokesman for Cleveland National Forest Foundation, had this to say about this week's appellate court findings on the county's climate change plan. He said, with regard to the politics of climate stabilization in San Diego County, George Orwell's quote is definitive. Political language is designed to make lies sound truthful and murder respectable, and to give an appearance of solidity to pure wind. The environmental leader adds, to be deceitful on climate change progress is worse than climate change denial, because it gives the public the illusion that we are heading in the right direction when we are actually making things worse. He provided a graph on total emissions showing a large gap between emission reduction targets and SANDAG's optimistic projections. McFetridge concludes, the gap graph proves that the entire region is headed in the wrong direction, toward a brick wall. Instead of embracing sprawl and freeways, he says, we must begin investing in transit and good city building now, before it is too late. As many of our listeners know, Gary McClintock, a famous saddle maker in Descanso who is well known to equestrians and horse owners across our region, was seriously injured in a motor vehicle accident recently. On November 29th, a benefit to help Gary and his family will be held at Descanso Feed and Hay. The Trail Challenges Clinic is being organized by Tyndall's Horse and Mule School to help horse and mule riders learn how to stay safe, calm, and confident on the trail. Now, if you want more information on the clinic, you can call Sherry at 619-672-4504. For those of you who may not be familiar with Gary McClintock, we thought today would be a good time to replay Helen Oldfield's interview with Descanso's famous saddle maker, originally aired last year on East County Magazine's Sounds of History segment.
This is Helen Oldfield from the Lemon Grove Historical Society bringing you the sounds of history. The sound of hoofbeats, the smell of sagebrush, the brilliant blue sky overhead. This is the world of my guest today, Gary McClintock, president of McClintock Saddle Works in Descanso, and one of East County's most famous residents. McClintock is to saddles what Willie Shoemaker was to horse racing. Their skills are enormous and particular. Gary, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Helen. That's well said and a little overstated, but thank you so much for such a nice introduction.
Oh,
I appreciate that.
Never, Gary, never overstated. I think you're one of the most popular people in East County and in the horse world.
I hope I don't have to live up to that.
You're such a Westerner, but where were you born and how long have you lived in East County?
Well, actually, I was born in Santa Monica, California, so I've lived my whole life in California. Came to San Diego in the 60s for college and have moved out to East County about that same time and kind of felt that this was a nice spot for me. So I've been there ever since.
So you were a city boy.
Well, we lived on the beach, actually, Helen.
Oh, golly.
In a place called Playa del Rey. So we started on the coast of California in the 50s. I was born in 1948. And we lived in a little place called Playa del Rey, which is right on the coast Actually, underneath the airport, pretty close to that.
My goodness, this makes you a quintessential Californian because you have experienced everything from the coast, the beautiful coast, the freeways, the incessant traffic, the smog. And what lured you to East County, to Descanso?
Well, actually, I was here for college at San Diego State.
Oh, yes.
And at that time, I actually moved to East County with a group of friends that college students that needed a place to live, and we found a little place in Pine Valley back in about 1967-68.
I have seen your custom saddles, and they are stunning. How long have you been making saddles?
Well, actually, Helen, we started in 1973, so this is my 40th year. We're celebrating our 40th anniversary right now. This is actually 40 years of building saddles.
What drives a young man to want to do that?
I think the desire to live out of town was the start. I wanted to work with my hands. I come from a family of dentists who also work with their hands, you see. But I was kind of a kickback of the hippie era and had to get out of town and live in the mountains and be away from the city, and it stuck with me. And I found saddles was something a friend recommended that I could. We were making belts before that, and then the recommendation came along, and I went to a school to learn how to build them because it was something I could do on my own, one at a time. I didn't have to be a factory or a manufacturer, which is what we became as belt makers. We got to the point where we were manufacturing belts for Pennies and Sears and people like that. Then I thought, no, I just want to be the custom little maker that I seen down in Mexico, to tell you the truth, down in San Blas, Mexico, on a surfing voyage. We were down in the square there and observed some artisans making belts and handbags and saddles. Well, not saddlebags, sandals, and then handbags. So we had the opportunity to enjoy that and thought, well, this guy has a pretty decent lifestyle. Right here on the coast, he can just do what he wants and sell it and catch waves when...
There's a real cultural context for this. The 1970s are often referred to as the time of the rebirth of the American craftsman. And there was a tremendous interest at that time in the handcrafted item. And actually, who was in the White House then? Mrs. Mondale.
Oh, really?
Yeah, made a big deal about bringing handmade pottery into the White House and serving dinners and whatnot on things made by artisans from America. So you were right in that groove. On average, if there is an average, how long does it take to design and make a Western saddle?
It's a good 7-day project. It takes a good 7 days to complete it. As long as it doesn't have a lot of the floral tooling, the carving or tooling, that takes somewhat more time. You could put another 40 hours into that if it was fully carved, you know, with the carving that you see, the floral decoration.
So someone comes to you and says, I must have a Western saddle. It needs to look in a certain way. It's on this particular kind of horse.
Exactly. I get a lot of people that come to me because they can't find first something that's going to work for their horse. So I accommodate that particular type of a horse by fitting the horse, you might say. I go out and take a look at it, which is what I'm going to do this afternoon. I'm on my way to Ramona this afternoon to take a look at a guy's horse and make sure that we get the right size saddle for him. His vet recommended that he come to me because I have a reputation of accommodating that type of a need. So that's where a lot of it starts there. A lot of it starts with people who can't find the style of saddle they prefer, let alone the size seat that fits them in that style with that fit for the horse. So there's three features there that they have to accommodate, and your typical manufactured products don't do that.
You know, when I was researching this topic, I came across a man who chewed the leather and pounded it with a mallet to make it pliable. And I assume you are not chewing the leather, but if you are, don't hesitate to share. Where do you get saddle leather? And do you have a favorite kind?
Well, there's a couple of tanneries left in the United States. The best tannery for that particular type of a vegetable tan leather, it's quite thick leather. It's done back in St. Louis. They do the best quality for saddles. There's been others, and there still are other makers, but a lot of EPA, Environmental Protection Agency stuff, has driven certain tanneries out of different areas like Los Angeles. There was quite a few makers there. A lot of it's being done in China, Mexico, out of the state and imported back. But the particular leather that I use comes out of St. Louis, Missouri, the Herman Oaks Tanning Company. So it's made here in the United States still. And it's just a real good quality leather all the way around. For all the features I need. I mean, I need a certain thickness. I need a leather that will tool easily, mold easily to the tree that I make the saddle upon.
Okay, the tree is the wooden...
It's the wooden frame that's been covered with rawhide. Okay. Rawhide is untanned leather.
Gary, is there any one saddle maker in history who inspired you?
Not an individual, but a company called the Visalia Saddle Company of California. I became, along the way, I got quite interested in historical stuff, California stuff, California Vaquero. I was consulted by a member, a guy named Ibanez from the Times newspaper up in Los Angeles. He requested a saddle out of this old catalog. This is like maybe 1975, 76. And it had some particular decoration on it that was braiding. It was rawhide braiding. And I just loved the look of it. And so I, from his request, I had to learn how to do all this stuff. And I went to, here in San Diego, there was a gentleman in the mountains out in Descanso named Granville Martin. And I spent time with him learning how to prepare this rawhide and then how to apply it to the saddle and make a nice decorative trim on the saddle, which is what Visalia used to do.
Nice.
And I thought, well, this is great. And so I've done a lot of saddles over the years that have that rawhide trim on it.
Gary, is it fair to say that your saddles are all over the United States?
Oh, absolutely.
All over North America?
Europe, quite a few there. Quite a few in... Northern Mexico. I sold saddles to cowboys and vaqueros down in, starting in about Tecate and maybe down as far as Ensenada. And I know there's even further, about halfway down the peninsula where we filmed the video, Corazon Vaquero. There's a couple of guys down there that I traded some saddles for.
Gary, that's a great segue. We're going to come back and renew this conversation. We're almost out of time. But Gary is not riding off into the sunset just yet. We're going to continue this conversation next time. Sit around, maybe chew some leather.
Probably not, hopefully, right?
Gary McClintock, thank you for coming. For the Sounds of History, I'm Helen Ofield.
This is Miriam Raftery.
And this is Ed Barena.
And today, now that the election's over with, we thought it might be worth putting in perspective for those of you who may be disillusioned, disappointed perhaps with some of the results, that this is nothing new. People have been complaining about politics and politicians all the way back to ancient times. The famous humorist from the 1800s, Mark Twain, once said, "Politics and diapers must be changed often, and for the same reason."
More recently, Jay Leno said, "If God wanted us to vote, he would have given us candidates."
There you go. There's a quote that's attributed to someone named Henry Kate VII, and it says, "The problem with political jokes is that they get elected." Now, a little disclaimer here. We looked all over the internet, and we couldn't find who Henry Kate was, but we like the quote, so we're including it anyway.
Yep, and here's one most people know pretty well, Aesop. "We hang the petty thieves and appoint the great ones to public office."
There you go. Aesop, who was famed for his fables. Plato, the ancient philosopher, stated, "One of the penalties for refusing to participate in politics is that you end up being governed by your inferiors." So there you go. For those of you that didn't vote, this is all your fault.
All right. And here's one that kind of a unique historical figure, Nikita Khrushchev. Politicians are the same all over. They promise to build a bridge even where there is no river.
Even bridges to nowhere, Ed. The German author Oskar Ameringer stated, "Politics is the gentle art of getting votes from the poor and campaign funds from the rich by promising to protect each from the other."
Here's one from an actual politician himself. Adlai Stevenson said, "I offer my opponents a bargain. If they will stop telling lies about us, I will stop telling the truth about them."
Texas Gwinnon was an actress, and she said, "A politician is a fellow who will lay down your life for his country."
My last quote here is from Doug Larson, who is a newspaper editor. It says, "Instead of giving a politician the keys to the city, it might be better to change the locks."
I like that one. And last but not least, George Orwell, the author of the dystopian novel 1984, wrote, "Political language is designed to make lies sound truthful and murder respectable and to give an appearance of solidity to pure wind."
This is a public service announcement from the nonprofit East County Magazine regarding the Viejas Wildfire and Emergency Alert Service. During a wildfire, it's critical to receive timely news about evacuations, shelters, threatened communities, and other vital information. Viejas Wildfire and Emergency Alerts are available free to the public via email, or you can receive the alerts via Twitter on your mobile phone. You can get information on how to sign up for these free alerts at www.eastcountymagazine.org. The Viejas Wildfire and Emergency Alerts are produced by East County Magazine with support from the Viejas Band of the Kumeyaay Nation.
This concludes today's episode of East County Magazine's radio show. We extend our appreciation to the East County Wellness Center for our studio space, to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County and Descanso. We extend our appreciation to our sound technicians, Leon Thompson and Ed Barena, and to our producer, Miriam Raftery. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, Jim Hannibal, Corey Clement, Giovanni Galicia and the Smashing Beats, Donnie Gentile, Wooden Ambulance, Dusty Summer Road, A.K. Jules, Brian Boykel, Royalty Free Music, Frank Nora, Kevin McLeod, April's Dance from the Smart Sound Solo Simplicity Collection, and Turco, Nomads of the Silk Road.
We also thank the County of San Diego for a community enhancement grant to support our Destination East County segment.
If you have story ideas or would like to underwrite the East County Magazine radio show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org or call 619-698-7617. We'll be back soon for another edition of East County Magazine's radio show.